Well, you may have heard Connecticut has made history again. That's right. Recently, Aaron Kirk, a lawyer and consumer advocate from Norwalk, was appointed to be Connecticut's and the nation's first cannabis ombudsperson. And she began her role a few weeks ago. She's a medical marijuana patient herself, and she's on the line with us. So we've got about 20 minutes or so to have a great conversation and meet this newest member of Connecticut's network of public service professionals. Is it okay for me to say that, Aaron?
Absolutely. I've led a lifetime of service. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And we appreciate you putting Connecticut on the map again. We may have been a little bit later to the game when it came to recreational use, but we were certainly out in front when it came to medical use. And your office has equal wherewithal over both of those consumer groups. But first, let's talk a little bit more about your background. Tell us a little bit about yourself and all of that incredible background of service that you're helping to bring to the table here in Connecticut.
Well, thanks, John. I am someone who grew up in Washington, D.C., and was told that service was the most important thing you could do. So all of my six siblings and I definitely are people that go out and try and make the world a better place, wake up with some sunshine and bring the light. So I went to law school at 30 after doing international maritime for a long time and realizing that I needed some more knowledge. So I went to law school. I did international relations and business. I was a UN roundtable. I had a UN roundtable with individuals from around the world. And after 20 years, I won a wonderful peace prize for negotiations among Middle East nations. And I then was also involved in some covert operations and was exposed to a lot of military that were suffering from various ailments. And between the international work and the veterans work, I realized cannabis was the key to getting a lot of people off the precipice and getting them back into society and making them whole again. So I kind of shifted about 15 years ago. And my brother Patrick Gorman and I started Cannabis Government Strategies, and we've been working up and down the East Coast, as well as California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon. And we're trying to bring different aspects, patient-centric legislation, social equity legislation, and equity principles to bear in the cannabis framework. And my point of view has always been looking towards the international market. So I'm really pleased that Connecticut is the first in the nation to have an ombudsman, because I have been hearing from people around the globe thinking, what a great idea. And other states, OCMs and MCA, the heads of their cannabis associations, have called me and said, how do we get that here? So I think I'll be helping other states kind of get the same system going. And hopefully we'll get a series of ombudsmen to help look out for patients' needs. Because again, as you said, I do believe that adult use and medical card users are all patients, but we do have that, you know, those two systems. So I'm trying to make sure here in Connecticut that the patients are not left behind as the adult use
go.
Robust framework. Thank you.
Yeah. So, let's steer clear of the moment that we are in regarding the social equity office, but broaden our focus to your background in social equity and how it can be sort of leveraged to do the best good in neighborhoods most affected and to people most affected by the war on drugs. I mean, you've kind of, parachuted into this position after Connecticut's social equity system had been in place even prior to the legalization of adult use cannabis. So let's talk about what you have seen in terms of social equity initiatives, where you feel that they work best, and maybe a little bit about how Connecticut might look to other states, counties, or organizations to make things as good as they can be here in the state of Connecticut.
Say that no state has really gotten social equity right. Illinois today has a press release out that they are the gold standard, and they've had many, many bumps along the way. My social equity focus was when we started the adult use, I knew some people in the community that wanted to apply, but they couldn't afford to hire people. So I eventually understand that I became the only lawyer in the state. Most of my friends around the country say in the country that did every application brought to me pro bono. So I didn't charge anybody anything. I put all their applications in and I said, if you win, make me your general counsel, bring me on, have me your compliance director, whatever you need. So several of those people did win and they hired me to help them as a consultant to get property. You know how hard that's been.
Yes.
And to get through zoning. So I have divested of all my clients because I've taken this new role, but it was such a joy to help people who, I mean, I've had people that have been incarcerated get licenses. And when they know that the thing that sent them to jail is now the thing that's going to bring their family a little bit of safety and comfort, it's just a great thing. In terms of social equity here, we started out really well, and unfortunately, the office wasn't staffed up as well as it could have been. And I think that we should have had more eyes on more things. So I think one of the things, you know, I also embarked in Maryland, and we tried to do something down there, but I had a client who was homeless for 8 months. She was otherwise qualified, but for those 8 months, she couldn't prove she was living in her car, so they wouldn't give her a license. Mm. Those kinds of gaps are really problematic for me and morally problematic because I know the woman was living there. Same things have happened here in Connecticut where social equity individuals didn't have the money for $3 million for a cultivation license. So they've entered into financial arrangements. And one person has publicly stated that his payback is a 250% interest rate. Mm. That's usurious. It should be against public policy to allow people that went to jail to then be kind of reincarcerated in an equity relationship
jail,
like that.
Yeah, in the jail of debt. Yeah,
it's a shame, you know, and they'll never get over it. And then we've had so many changes along the way that, you know, even in terms of social equity, if you had a social equity plan, you went to communities and you spoke to people about how they wanted to see changes and how they wanted money invested. Was it youth organizations? Was it anti-domestic violence? What was it? So people have really been earnestly trying to find those partners. And then they put their plans in, and then the plans were changed in February. Again, July 1, the plans changed. People were calling me crying, saying, I've spent months getting my plan together, and now if I don't get it in by midnight Sunday, I'll have to start from the beginning, or at least I'll have to change a lot, and I don't have the money. So I know people were literally pulling all-nighters to meet that June 30 deadline. When something is done like that as a public policy matter, I've never seen it. We had a meeting Thursday. It's effective Monday. Mm-hmm. I believe a 2-week administrative leeway is a courtesy that should be afforded to everyone, particularly social equity people. And if I might just be super liberal on this, I find it very problematic in every state, not just Connecticut, that you say someone is social equity because they've lived in a disproportionate area, they've had a number of arrests, their family has been incarcerated, or they themselves have. Then they get a business because, hey, it's legal now and everybody's making a lot of money, so we'll give you a break. But now we're going to make you give back to your community with a social equity plan. And that's not a terrible thing, but it is somewhat burdensome that they're repairing the war that was done to them. But and worse, I think, is you make them go back to the disproportionate area. Many places won't even let them in. And then you send them back to the source of their trauma. Why are you doing that? Let them put their businesses up where they can put them up. I understand why there are DIA maps and they've been modified and all that good stuff, but I still, as a public policy matter, find it troubling that, you know, the guy who got arrested in New Haven now can only put his shop in New Haven pretty much because that's where, you know, where he knows and that's the DIA. I just think you should have a free market, and that extends to the whole framework. We have brought no equity principles to the table here. We have 7-year and 3-year ownership. We have 51% and 65%. People are not investing in these businesses because it's too long of a period of time for them to get their money back. And I think we should have, because of that, and that's, we did that for a reason. We wanted to protect people, and I get that, and I think that's great. But why didn't we use some of the money that went into the social equity fund, the $40 million, to fund some of these businesses? New Jersey gives $250,000 to social equity people. I know 10 guys that have gotten it, and it has made all the difference. So we're giving money back to communities, but many of them have been like the United Way. Again, I've worked with the United Way for 40 years. They're great, but they don't need our $1 million. The guy that went to jail that has to pay $3 million needs that money. Yes. And I just feel like we could have reinvested in our own people before we reinvested in multinational or in national organizations. It's just, I have a background in NGOs, and I've gone into countries and just, you know, started NGOs. And so I just would have done it a little differently. But not that anybody asked me, but I do think you should bring equity principles to the table. And I think you should provide funding for the people that have been most impacted. Otherwise, the rich people are coming in. And I can't really divulge, but I have seen shocking arrangements where people have done everything and they own 2% of the company in 3 years. And it's just, it's been a way for multinational companies to come in here and take advantage of social equity individuals under the guise of promoting or providing generational wealth, which is a term we don't even use anymore because it's probably not possible in this space. And it's kind of, it's exploitative, frankly. And I just, it's very worrisome that I want to see who actually owns these companies in 5, 7, 10 years. You know, is it all MSOs? And that could be an M&A and a descheduling, rescheduling thing. But even if none of that were going to happen, we have not put our own citizens up for the success I think we could have had we given them a little money.
Well, on a positive note, I'm really glad to hear as you build and weave in information about your background that that Connecticut powers that be were astute enough to welcome someone into this Connecticut cannabis ombudsperson position who has such a kind of a global perspective, because that can only hopefully move the needle in the right direction. We're talking with Erin Kirk. She's Connecticut's cannabis ombudsperson, first in Connecticut, first in the nation. And I want to give Erin a quick break and reach out to the folks that might be listening in our more rural areas of Connecticut, because I've learned people living in rural areas experience significantly higher rates of both obesity and chronic illnesses associated with obesity. Many rural areas also have an increasing lack of access to healthcare resources. So finding better ways to help those folks manage their weight could have big benefits for both individuals and society. That's all of our tax dollars, folks. So the University of Virginia School of Medicine researchers, together with their colleagues at the University of South Carolina, are heading up a study that you're welcome to apply to be part of here in Connecticut to determine if online behavioral weight management programs for rural residents can be improved by adding a human touch. The goal is to help residents of rural areas where in-person weight loss programs can be scarce. So the study is currently enrolling participants for a group starting in August of this year and is going to continue accepting applications into 2025. There are going to be phased startups of this program. You may qualify. If you'd like to learn more about this program, just go to ireachstudy.org. That's the letter I, the word reachstudy.org. So once again, we're talking with Erin Kirk, Connecticut's and the nation's first cannabis ombudsperson. Erin, as we're talking about social equity for just another minute or two, share your rear view mirror view of the success stories that you've been able to witness or experience as a result of programs that are basically working as good as they can for these individuals.
Well, I have a 97-year-old Korean War veteran who's very happy with the fact that he has been able to get off a lot of his medications, and he uses a tincture and he uses gummies and he sleeps beautifully now. And a lot of people have told me, you know, I think most of the people that are utilizing cannabis are over the age of 40. I know that none of my kids use it and none of their friends, very few of their friends really do. But all the people I've met over 50 are helping with pain and with anxiety and with sleep. So there are a lot of success stories. And I think that we initially were doing a great job. I think we are still doing a good job. We just need to get more products on the market for the patients here.
Right. And that's another big push that you're going to be initiating or have already begun to initiate. And that's in terms of the disparity between products in dispensaries exclusively for medical qualified patients versus the general public consumers, right?
Right, exactly. It seems to me, I've visited some of the, I've visited a lot of the dispensaries, some hybrids, some, you know, different dispensaries, and I've gone to the producers, and I am seeing that, you know, because we have THC percentages that are higher allowed for patients, medical card patients, because I think everybody's a patient, but for medical card holders, the producers really aren't making as many high test products as they used to because they aren't having enough to sell into. So I think that we need to somehow induce furtherance of medical products. I don't know if we should have a micro medical license here where they just grow 500 to 2,000 square feet and just sell to the medical community, or whether if we have another lottery, we should insist that the retails are hybrid. I know that we don't have the ombudsman position was created by Senate Bill or HB 6699. And in the section after the ombudsman, it says that you're supposed to have a task force to study caregivers and home grow and how we would help in the palliative sense, the medical community. And that has never taken place. It was supposed to take place a month after passage, much like my position was supposed to be filled October 1st of last year and was filled June 1st of this year. Everything is behind. But I would like to find out why that task force has apparently never been formed. And I would like to form it. And I'd like to be on it if I could, because I think what we need to do is take a holistic look and find out why we are having 60,000 patients registered or almost, and now we're down to 39.6. I think the reason is a lack of products. And I've heard from over 35 patients already, and they all tell me the same thing. They cannot get their products consistently, their medication consistently, and the prices are very high. And when you're on a fixed income, that's a problem. So another initiative I'm trying to work on is one with a company called Tetragram, which has partnered with the state of Colorado's workman's compensation division. And they have a pilot program where they are taking patients and asking these patients who've been injured on the job whether they would like to take traditional pharmaceutical medication or cannabis. Colorado's pretty progressive in that way. And those that are choosing the cannabis route have to use an app. Their doctor has to prescribe a certain product. It can't be a smokable or vapable product. And we don't have any names because we worry about pay to play. So, for example, for sleep, you take a 5-milligram gummy. Well, the patient goes out and buys the product, takes a picture, downloads it to the app, and is required to give sort of a review so that the producer knows, is this product truly efficacious? And the caregiver can also learn, is this the right product, not just for this patient, but for this ailment? And once they do that, they get reimbursed up to $350 a month from the insurance company, not the state. And $4,200 to a veteran or anyone on a fixed income, myself included, is substantial. I would love to see the insurance capital of the world, Connecticut, institute a program like that for our patients. I think it would just mean a world of difference. And I also think it might induce producers to make more products for the medical market. And I think more people would come back to the patient space. People tell me they don't register as a cannabis patient now because it's $100 to $250 to get certified. Now, the state is no longer charging a fee, but you still have to go to a doctor. Mm. And the range is about $99 to $250. And then, you know, it's very expensive. We've got moon rocks here, which I think are hilarious, for $60 a gram. I mean, it's going to be gone in two uses. It's not going to be an effective medication. So what we really need to do is just figure this whole thing out and just try to do better by the patients. I think that we can induce producers to do better if we can get reinsurance, you know, insurance. I think they'd say, wow, you know, we're going to have a lot more to sell.
Yeah, but you said from its highest point to today, we've lost like 50% of medical use, or approaching 50% of medical use, patients off the rolls.
Yeah.
Are they simply just letting their cards lapse and or are keeping their cards and not patronizing Connecticut dispensaries and just driving across one of the borders to spend their money and support the tax rolls of a neighboring state?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. A lot of people.
That may have been the shortest answer you ever gave in an interview. How about that? You made history again, Aaron. You made history again. Yes, you said yes to a question.
I didn't even throw in that I'm Italian.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But the answer is yes. I mean, when you have the rent is too damn high, people are going to move. So when you have the cannabis is $60 for, something that might last you 2 days, why not drive an extra half an hour and get something for $60 that lasts a week?
So the effort that Connecticut put out to try to also make this not just a palliative, but a revenue generating situation, we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot because we're lacking the wherewithal to be able to provide the products here in our state that the patients, potentially the most important demographic of cannabis consumers in the state of Connecticut, we're closing the door to them and forcing them to just go next door.
Right. I've talked to over 40 caregivers, and every single person has told me that patients can't get what they want consistently. Once they find that good tincture or that good Bigelow tea, used to make tea. I've got to call my friend Cindy Bigelow. Yes. We need the tea. And I mean, now that there's no tea, people are driving to other states to get different things. And I think, a lot of people are telling me that I was using a product for 7, 8, 10 months. And then I went back and it wasn't there. I had a man call me livid the other day. He's got a neurological condition. He's a CEO of a major corporation. He happens to be a Republican. And he said, I want to testify because no one will believe that a guy like me needs cannabis to get through the day. I am the opposite of what anyone would think was a cannabis user. My son died of a drug overdose. I have been sober from alcohol for 35 years, but I have a neurological condition. And the only thing that helped me was cannabis. And he uses a specific strain. Well, he went to Blue Point Wellness 2 weeks ago and couldn't find it. And he literally sat in his car under a neurological situation and was breaking down. My heart was in pieces. Yeah. I mean, this is a 65-year-old man who just wants to just walk. And he can't sleep at night because he's got this restless leg neurological thing. And I mean, it's heartbreaking. All we have to do is get consistent products. But one of the issues is we had cultivation licenses at $3 million. No one could afford to do it. So very few seeds are in the ground. There are some seeds in the ground, but they're not making products particularly for patients. I mean, we've got a guy that's growing outdoors and he's freeze drying everything and making it into vapes, but that's not the kind of thing that patients are looking for. They're looking for tinctures. They're looking for creams. They're looking for tea.
Yeah, I get it.
They're looking for things that, and they want that consistency. And I have had so many caregivers call me and say, not only can we not find it, but when we call the dispensaries, they're just aggressive with us. They won't talk to us. They don't want to communicate with us. I think we need to bring everybody to the table and have a kumbaya moment and say, listen, this is the reason we're here. And you can't be against people calling and asking just for information so that the customer, your customer, and their patient can come to you and buy what they need. Mm. Why wouldn't you talk to the caregiver and hear that feedback?
Yeah, well,
but,
Aaron, let's...
I mean, they won't even answer their calls.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it at that and just remind people how they can get in touch with you. And we want to circle back with you in a couple of months and pick up the conversation from there, because it sounds like you're ready to rock and roll and make some difference. And you don't sound like the person that would get nothing done in 2 or 3 months. So I definitely am excited to pick up the next chapter of our conversation in a month or two. But in the meantime, if people
do... Has it been 20 minutes?
It's been 23:50. I told you I'd let you go, but I'm running out of room and I've got, we got a couple other guests we need to accommodate
okay,
here.
I'm going to let you boogie.
But how do people reach you?
Well, I want to say what we talked about before we came online was I do believe everyone that uses cannabis is a patient. I used it for years and didn't realize I was using it for certain things and then realized, oh, I'm a patient. So anyone in the system, please get in touch with me at aaron.kirk@ct.gov, or my phone number is 860-874-0303. That's 860-874-0303. I want to hear from everybody. Give me something to go to the legislature with. I need anyone that wants any legislative changes to bring me anything they want by September 1, because I have to get my asks to the governor's office by October 1. One of the things I'm going to be asking for is robust patient assistance. I would love to have a staff. I would love to have a budget. I would love to be able to make this a robust office that really can help our patients and center Connecticut for the international and the interstate commerce to come. So I appreciate you, sir.
Yes.
You're a wonderful gentleman. Thank you. I appreciate you putting a spotlight on this because I'm hoping people even know that I'm here. So good. Thank you.
erin.kirk@ct.gov is Aaron's email address. Aaron Kirk is the nation's first cannabis ombudsperson, and we've got her right here in Connecticut, and I think you're getting the idea that she is definitely going to be going to work for us here in the state. So thank you, Aaron, as well. We appreciate you, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Introducing Workhorse, the highly anticipated debut novel from author Caroline Palmer. A story of envy and ambition set against the glamour and privilege of media and high society in New York City at its height. A brilliant page-turner about the outrageous sacrifices women must make for the sake of success. Available now wherever books are sold.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.